This is the Jason Jones Show, powered by Mudhouse Media. Now, here's Jason Jones.
Aloha, everybody, and welcome to the Jason Jones Show. I am your host, Jason Jones, broadcasting from Waikiki Beach on the island of Oahu, on the most beautiful island chain in the world, the Hawaiian Islands, the great state of Hawaii. Today, we continue, I believe, what is it, day four? I don't even know. We're continuing on our 49 days in a row, R-O-E, in celebration of the overturning of Roe v. Wade. As Father Frank Pavone said, the Supreme Court opened the door. Now we need to walk through it and create a culture of life. It is up to us. And today, I wanted this guy to be our first guest. It's Dr. Michael New. And in fact, he was the first person I interviewed when the opinion was leaked. But it was so long ago, it took them till the very end of the session to release the ruling, that I thought we would just record it again so it would be fresh. And Dr. Michael New is a research associate of political science and social research at the Catholic University of America, as well as an associate scholar at the Charlotte Lozier Institute. Additionally, he is a fellow with the Witherspoon Institute in Princeton, New Jersey. Dr. New has both a PhD in political science and a master's degree in statistics from Stanford University. What I'm trying to say is he is the single best person for us to interview from our side. I want to find his counterpart on the other side, because I'd like to interview them too. But he's the single best person in the world for us to interview to get a comprehensive, I'm in Hawaii. You know, I just had garlic shrimp and rice. So if I'm tongue-tied, it's because my mouth is still dancing. But he's the best person to interview to give us a comprehensive overview of what did the pro-life movement get right over the past 50 years. So before the interview, though, I got to let you know, this episode is being brought to you by Epic Times. And if you care about faith, family, and freedom, and leaving your children and grandchildren and our posterity a culture of life, love, and beauty, you need to get Epic Times. It needs to be the first place you go every day. It is for me. And if you want the best price on the digital and print subscription, go to iReadEpoch.com, use the code Jason Jones, and you get that deal. I get the print and digital. Why? I want the print paper laying around so my kids pick it up and read it. And I need the digital subscription, so it's easy for me to share on social media. The episode is also being brought to you by MyPillow.com. Go to MyPillow.com and use the code Jones. Jason Jones for the paper, Jones for the pillows. There is no better way to celebrate the overturning of Roe v. Wade than stick it to the cancel culture who's trying to cancel Mike Lindell for Standing for Life and get yourself a pillow. You got the pillows? Really? But do you have the mattress topper? Do you have the Giza Dream sheets? With the code Jones, when you click on the radio listener square, you get deep discounts on all the great products. And in the midst of 49 days of podcasting, the Vulnerable People Project, the main sponsor of this show, is busy building a women's center, a woman's medical center in Afghanistan, with a new well that is being drilled right now. We're providing schools for the only girls' schools left in Afghanistan. We're providing security cameras and a security team for those schools. And of course, we're continuing to work to resettle those Afghans who are in jeopardy because they served us. When you become a monthly donor of the Vulnerable People Project, you are standing in solidarity with the most vulnerable people in the world, from the child in the womb right here at home to children around the world. So go to thegreatcampaign.org, give your best one-time gift, and become a monthly donor. All right, here we go. A comprehensive overview, a seminar on what did the pro-life movement get right to get us to this point. Dr. Michael New, the Jason Jones Show. Dr. Michael New, welcome to the Jason Jones Show.
Oh, thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
Thanks for being so patient, and thanks for doing the show again. because we did the show, I believe, like the day the opinion was leaked. And I thought, you know, so much has happened and maybe you've gained some broader insights over the past couple of weeks. I think now over a month, really. And I wanted to have you on the show. I wanted you to be the first guest to kick off this 49 days in a row bonanza celebration of life. Father Frank Pavone said, all the court did was open the door to a cult, open the door. Is the culture of death going to run through that door, or are we going to run through that door? That's up to us.
Well, we have to be the ones running through the door, and Father Frank is right. This is not the end. It's just the beginning. You know, we can really, for the first time since 1973, start passing laws that really legally protect preborn children. We don't tinker around the edges anymore. We can pass laws that really provide comprehensive protection. And so far, you know, we're off to a pretty good start, I think. You know, the numbers change based on litigation, but my understanding is as of now, about 11 states are really protecting preborn children throughout pregnancy. Another state, Ohio, has a heartbeat law in effect, which is going to protect preborn children after about 6 to 8 weeks gestation. And I think within a few weeks, there'll be around 16 states protecting preborn children throughout pregnancy and about 3 more states with heartbeat bans. So we have a ways to go, but we're off to a good start.
Now, I want to do the show on what did we get right? What did the pro-life movement get right over the past 50 years, really, even more, a little longer than that? When you sketch out a screenplay, you have, you know, the ordinary world before the adventure begins and the inciting incident. So the inciting incident of this story, would that be Roe v. Wade? And then that was when that the hero's journey began for all of those who marched toward a culture of life.
Right. I mean, we got several things right. I mean, one thing, and I would say the most important thing, was we kept the issue salient. If you look at kind of U.S. history, whenever the Supreme Court issues a decision on a public policy issue that people care about, a lot of the time that just ends the debate right there, that there's really no further political action or legislative action occurs. Thankfully, that didn't happen. And pro-lifers, I thought, did a really good job just keeping this issue alive and keeping it in front of people. You know, the first March for Life was in 1974. It was supposed to be a one-time event. But thankfully, Nellie Gray and the other organizers had the vision to keep the march going. And it's really hard for the media to ignore hundreds of thousands of people descending upon Washington every January. And they did their best to ignore us, but it's hard to ignore us. So just keeping the issue sailing through the March for Life, through things like just sidewalk counseling and educational programs, and also politically, just the fact that, you know, this is more common in the 70s than today, but when there was not a pro-life candidate running for an office, a pro-life person would run. And they wouldn't necessarily win, but they'd get 5, 10, 15%, and the other candidates would notice that, hey, you know, I could use some extra votes next time I ran, and often they'd change their position. So just keeping the issue salient was important. I'd say another big thing we did right was we got involved with politics. And we, you know, worked our way through the system. We became more invested in the Republican Party. And it just became, you know, realistic for Republicans after a while that if you want to do business in the Republican Party, you had to be pro-life. There just wasn't really any other way around that. So we did well, you know, getting the Hyde Amendment passed. You know, that limited the ability of the federal government to fund elective abortions through Medicaid. That continues to save tens of thousands of lives every year. By my estimate, saved over 2.4 million lives since 1976. And we also really started to emphasize judicial nominations in ways that were helpful. I mean, some of your listeners forget that, sad to say, Republicans used to kind of roll over and play dead when Democrats nominate somebody. When Ruth Bader Ginsburg was nominated by President Clinton in 1993, only 3 Senate Republicans voted against her. When Stephen Breyer was nominated in 1994 by President Clinton, only 9 Republicans voted against him. So we eventually started taking judicial nominations seriously, and that's paid some dividends. I think we were right to push back against Harriet Myers. I don't know what kind of Supreme Court judge she would have made, but I don't think she would have written a strong opinion that Justice Alito wrote, striking down Roe v. Wade. We were right to push back against Merrick Garland. You know, we didn't give President Obama another Supreme Court justice. We were right to push ahead with Brett Kavanaugh and ignore the allegations that seemed kind of spurious and move forward with his nomination. And we were right to push forward with Amy Coney Barrett. You know, we didn't exactly have a big window of time there, but we did get her nomination through. She was obviously a nominee with a lot of attractive qualities, And obviously, the judicial nominees, you know, made the big difference. You know, that's why Roe v. Wade was overturned. And I'd say the last thing we got right, even probably the most important thing, is that we just never gave up. You know, we never, ever gave up. We had our ups and downs. You know, there were talks of the whole party, you know, abandoning the pro-life plank in the party platform. You know, there were election losses. When the case decision came down in 1992, and we thought they'd overturn Roe v. Wade at that point, and it wasn't a disappointment, it wasn't a setback. You know, but we just kept moving, you know, through the Clinton years, through the Obama years. We never gave up. We always tried to keep this issue front and center. And Friday, we succeeded. And it's a great victory.
Yeah, I want to draw you out on these different points, starting with the last one. I really think they could not imagine our fortitude. And Cecile Richards said once that pro-lifers are like gnats. When you swipe them away, more show up. And the youth, as Kristen Hawkins calls this, the pro-life generation, that's not a wishful thinking. They are the pro-life generation. I've just seen the eruption on social media and all of sort of the organic, really witty and funny Instagram posts and TikTok posts are coming from young people who are pro-life. You look at Babylon Bee, you know, it seems like now we're in pole position, not only in the court, but also in the culture. I mean, Damon of Athens, the musicologist, said, "Give me the songs of a nation, and I care not who writes its laws." It's as if the left is writing propaganda points, but organic kind of cultural eruptions are coming from young people who are pro-life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one good decision we made was to really start making some investments in youth outreach. And, you know, I've been doing pro-life work since, you know, 1993 or so. I think I probably attended my first March for Life, I think, January of 2003. You know, but young people were not as prevalent at the marches, you know, they were today. I know I've talked to people who attend Notre Dame, and they said in the 80s, you know, a small contingent of Notre Dame undergrads would come to D.C. for the march. Now there's been busloads and busloads of people, and that's true for other schools as well. So you really see a lot of colleges, especially a lot of Catholic and Christian colleges, you know, big contingents of people. You know, Students' Life's done a great job organizing pro-lifers on college campuses. I always enjoy attending the summit after the March for Life. It's great to see, you know, thousands of young people excited to build a culture of life. So, again, I think that, you know, I always tell my students that, you know, young people aren't the future of the pro-life movement, but the present of the pro-life movement. A lot of work on this issue, frankly, both for good and for ill, has been done by young people. So I'm glad young people are investing in youth outreach. I'm glad young people are stepping up and doing more. It's exciting to watch.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to push back a little. I don't think we ever invested in the youth the way we should. But I think when the advent of Facebook and social media, young people just showed up. They were able to communicate, create content, build organizations, and find their people. And you know, you have been a good – I hate to use this word. The left is word – ruined this word. But you have been a really good friend and ally – to sort of the diverse groups in the pro-life movement that have shown up that we would have never been able to reach out to, but they've just found each other on the internet, on social media, and found out, hey, you know, I don't fit the mold of what I think pro-lifers are, conservative Republicans or devout Catholics or fundamentalist Christians, I'm whatever else. And, but they find each other, and they're really the most vocal and aggressive wing of the pro-life movement now, aren't they?
No, absolutely. That, you know, I think groups like Secular Pro-Life have done a great job. You know, that the good thing about the internet is people, you know, can find like-minded people a lot easier. And, you know, that's true of pro-lifers, but it's also true of pro-lifers who, you know, may have liberal views on certain public policy issues or who may not be religious and they define themselves as atheist or agnostic. And, you know, Secular Pro-Life is a group that's done some really good work, especially giving a kind of good, logical, scientific reasons to oppose abortion. You know, I'm good friends with Teresa Bukovnik of Progressive Anti-Abortion Uprising. You know, she's been at the Supreme Court almost every decision day. You know, her group does a great job with street-level activism and just really trying to be a very visible presence, building a culture of life. So just great seeing kind of non-traditional groups getting involved, playing a role. I mean, everybody has a role to play. For the culture of life, you know, nobody should be excluded. And I'm glad to see, you know, people taking that initiative.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the biggest mistakes the left has made is a mistake I made. I remember when I first met the women from Feminists for Life, over 20 years ago. And I think I must have met you at your very first March for Life, because I feel like I've known you forever. And when I met you, I felt like I knew you forever and you'd been a part of the movement forever. But when I first met some of the leadership of the Feminists for Life, I just assumed they were AstroTurf. I assumed they were evangelical Christian moms who, you know, slapped on the feminist label and advocated for life. And I was startled. Oh my gosh, they're really feminists. You know, you work with POW and you're like, oh my goodness, they're really progressives. And I think the left has made that mistake to their detriment, that they treat these feminist pro-life groups, they treat these progressive and secular pro-life groups, these LGBT pro-life groups, they treat them as if they're AstroTurf. And they're not. I don't know if they really believe that they are. They can't imagine that truly progressive people would, quote-unquote progressive, whatever that means, are pro-life. But I think to their detriment, they're not responding to the real challenge, which is this real unfurling of a pro-life left.
No, absolutely. I think that, you know, my commentary I've seen just dismisses these groups. You know, lots of the pro-abort groups just say these are, you know, stooges or, you know, they're AstroTurf groups. You know, they don't engage their arguments, which is, I think, certainly their detriment. And I think that, you know, groups have a really, like that, have a unique role to play. I know that when I was a grad student at Stanford, we collaborated with the pro students at Berkeley and did a conference with them. And we actually had a rally featuring Farron Foster, a Feminist for Life. And the only thing I remember about that rally, you know, is that various points, some of the left-wing students were cheering because they actually liked what she had to say. I remember Farron Foster came to Berkeley and said, I think UC Berkeley should do more to help pregnant students and parenting students. Everyone applauded. You know, even the people who weren't pro-life thought that was a good idea. So, you know, I think that, you know, they do have legitimate arguments that, you know, that need to be engaged. The other side just ignores them and blows them off, and that's their detriment.
Yeah, no, that was Farron Foster was the one I met, and I was like, oh, she's really a feminist, and I was taken aback. I, too, misjudged, right? I also misjudged, and I guess that is the failure, right? If they're not taking their arguments seriously, then their arguments are being left to stand. Now, I think that their arguments are sound, but they wouldn't, but yet they don't even address them. And so, well, maybe now we'll go to the courts. I would say the same thing with the courts, right? They're failing, just as the left or the abortion industry has failed to even try to take seriously the arguments of the pro-life left, which, you know, they're shocked when I see pro-life left groups responding to how American corporations will pay for your abortion but not your maternity leave. These types of arguments are very powerful, and if they're not going to address them, they're going to continue to lose. Same thing in the courts. I have not come across a single lawyer on any of these cable news networks from the left. I've not a single abortion industry spokesperson address the opinions of the court. It's just ad hominem attacks and gaslighting, and they're letting the opinions stand unchallenged.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think that at some level, I think even our opponents have to realize that Roe is just a really weak decision. You know, it's not supported at all by the text or the history of the Constitution. And at the time it was released, it got a lot of criticism. Even a lot of, you know, liberal law professors who were sympathetic to legal abortion thought Roe was a truly lousy constitutional law or a truly lousy jurisprudence. And I think at some level they know that. It's a very hard decision to come out and defend. So, yeah, I think that's what they have. It's the best defense they had. Even saw this during the oral argument was just precedent. You know, this is the way the court ruled. And, you know, the court is you know, preserves legitimacy, just needs to reaffirm its previous ruling. Now, if the best argument you can make is the stare decisis or precedent, that's just weak. I mean, I think that everyone sees it. If the best argument you can make is that, well, that's the way the court ruled previously, that's not much of an argument.
Yeah, I mean, those are the what would we call them? Hyper-originalists? I thought originalists were to be shunned. Now, you know, I'm an activist. You're an activist, but you're also an academic. And I think one of the greatest successes of the pro-life movement has been its disunity. You know, people would often kvetch that we need to be more unified. I think unity would have been disastrous. The disunity of all the different cultural and activist and legal and political groups and strategies and temperaments coming in at the abortion industry from every direction just was overwhelming. But don't we owe a lot of credit to groups like the Federalist Society?
No, absolutely. The Federalist Society did, you know, a lot of good. The sanctity of life issues have never really been their priority as such, but they've done a really good job just developing and training a very good network of constitutionalist judges and constitutionalist lawyers. I mean, the quote-unquote conservative legal world was not really that well developed when, like, Ronald Reagan was president. And when he wanted to nominate a judge, he didn't really have that many, frankly, good chances to choose from. That changed a lot. You know, George W. Bush and Donald Trump have had a much better selection, many more choices as far as good judges as to whom to nominate. So, I think the Federalist Society, again, even though sanctity of life issues was really, not their priority, they developed a good farm team of judges, which we're benefiting from. And I also think we benefit from the fact that, some other groups, whose main priority may not have been pro-life or sanctity of life, they started to realize that courts are important. That seemed to be that pro-lifers are the only ones best in judicial battles. But as the court's dealing with a wide range of issues, I think other center-right groups have kind of come on board. They want to see good constitutionalist judges, nominated and confirmed to the courts. And I think that's helped us out as well.
Yeah, and groups like, Carrie Severino from the Judicial Confirmation Network. And I'm an activist. Have you ever seen, you must have seen Amazing Grace, the William Wilberforce movie. Have you seen that?
Actually, I'm not sure if I've seen the movie, but I know the story.
Oh, you would know if you saw it. Well, you've got to see it because it reminds us, these abolitionists in Great Britain reminded me so much of our movement, where you have those who of a more conservative temperament, and then you have the drunken Jacobin who's radical. I think in the pro-life movement, I would have been the drunken Jacobin, And there's been a lot of frustration from the activists with those who are, and I guess I've straddled culture, activism, and politics, and my frustration has often been with those who are looking to the courts to end abortion, feeling that they were taking an overly conservative approach. But 50 years is a long time in the life of a person, but in the life of a movement, it's a blink of an eye. And so, I am grateful for all of those lawyers and who I guess they were doing what they needed to do at the pace, with the strategies and tactics that they needed to do it.
Right. I mean, it's kind of hard to, this is a tough issue to navigate because, we as activists, we can't really force the Supreme Court to, review a certain law. The Supreme Court kind of makes those decisions in its own way, kind of on its own time. And I'll be kind of honest, we made progress on this, in many respects, faster than I thought we would. Kind of when I've been working on this issue, I kind of thought that the reversal of Roe would be pretty gradual. I thought at some point down the road, they'll let us protect preborn children after 20 weeks gestation. And maybe we'll have some luck, pushing the gestation age limit back a bit. And, we'll be able to, protect preborn children in a wider range of circumstances. So I know we just sort of building incrementally. I'm kind of surprised that we got this done in one fell swoop. I'm very grateful. But progress in some respects happened more quickly than even I would think. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, no, and I know a lot of that. There are even those activists today who are saying the court didn't go far enough, and this isn't a victory at all, and it's not until human life is protected from biological beginning, from sea to shining sea, that we can celebrate. But I look at this as, no, you need to celebrate all of those milestones, not be distracted by them, not think that you've reached the finish line. In one of my articles, I said that this was, with John Zmirak, that this is Dunkirk, not Normandy. And I think that's a good way of putting it. I think Father Pavone he put it perfectly when he said all the court did was open the door. Mm-hmm. All the court did
was open the door. I agree. I mean, really, we have our work cut out for us. I mean, we obviously have a situation now where we can pass laws, and obviously, there's some conservative states that have moved quickly or that will move quickly, and there's some states that are going to need a little more prodding and a little more political pressure, and there's some states that are just going to be very, tough sledding for us, and we have to work on that. So good things are going to happen, but we still need to keep working. The other thing to keep in mind is that, even though we've overturned Roe v. Wade and we're passing good protective laws in many states, unintended pregnancies are not going to stop happening. There's still going to be many, many women in need. And our pregnancy help centers do a great job. There's 2,700 of them. They offer a great range of services to women in need, whether it's shelter, counseling, healthcare, et cetera. But we need to step our efforts to really make sure they have the resources they need, that they're going to probably getting a lot more requests for help. And I think, you know, we as pro-lifers have to make sure that we're supporting them as much as we can to make sure they can assist those women in need.
Yeah, we all need, all of us, everyone listening, needs to be engaged with their local crisis pregnancy center that serves those vulnerable young women in your very community. I mean, that should be the very first step for anyone who's looking to get involved. If you're listening going, I wish I could do more, there's something we can all do, which is donate to the best of our ability to our local pregnancy center. And some of us will be in a position to call in and volunteer. If you're an electrician, they'll have those needs. If you're an accountant, they'll have those needs. Plumber, painter, carpenter, like these pregnancy centers really thrive off of volunteer support, donations, and there's just nothing better you can do. I want to go to the March for Life. That's how you kicked it off. And I'm glad you did, because the March for Life is one of those events that's just spectacular. And I don't know, is there going to be a March for Life in the coming year to celebrate?
My understanding is yes, that there will be a March for Life in January of 2023. I'm not really sure what's going to happen beyond then. Personally, it's up to me. I would actually keep marching in January. That may not be the opinion others share, but I think that an annual march is to remember the 60 million lives we lost.
Ooh,
is important to do.
March for Remembrance.
I also think that, I hate to say it, but you know, somebody is going to organize a January pro-life march. Maybe somebody sincere, maybe an opportunist, but there's going to be a January march anyway. I really prefer to see the March for Life staff be the ones running it. And then I think it would be a good idea in the summer just to have like 50 state marches or 50 states plus D.C. Again, we need to really, you know, do work at the state level and make sure the states are passing good protective pro-life laws and just make sure that pregnancy centers in those states, you know, have the resources they need.
Yeah, I'd like to see the March for Life come out, the March for Life committee come out and support a human life amendment to the Constitution. You know, so the March for Life was – one of those, the March for Life committee is one of those organizations that I've heard criticized relentlessly by pro-life leaders and pro-life activists. Oh, they don't do enough. They don't do this. They don't do that. I was one of them. I remember with Nellie Gray, I would argue with Nellie. I have this with the Passion of the Christ when it was coming out. I begged, you know, can we have Jim Caviezel speak? And she said, I don't want this to become a circus sideshow for Hollywood. And I don't want, we need to keep doing what we've been doing and continued to doing. And I remember thinking in 2004, yes, right before The Passion came out, I organized my own event at another hotel, and it was really big, and it invited, and a lot of young people came. And I think it was almost as big as the March for Life's main event at their hotel. And I thought, why don't they see, look at this, look what we were able to pull off. But of course, that fizzled. It was just a one-off around a great big movie. And what the March for Life did is it did what it did, and it did what it was supposed to do. And it knit us together as a movement year in and year out. It wasn't distracted by bells and whistles and fads, by movies, by political enthusiasms. It kept focused. Nellie Gray had a vision, and they stuck to that vision. And it is really the most unbelievable annual march in the history of our republic. And most of you, many of you may not even know about this. It's just hundreds of thousands of people year in and year out now for almost five decades descended on Washington, D.C.
Yep, and the neat thing is that the march was intended to become a one-time event. You know, people, you know, pro-lifers in D.C. kind of scrambled together and said, you know, on the anniversary of Roe, we should do something to remember it. And, you know, I think that, you know, from the media accounts I've read, maybe 5,000 people came. You know, it was a start. And then someone, thankfully, I think they had some extra money raised, and people were running to do with the extra money, and someone said, why don't we put toward next year's march? And they kept doing the March for Life year after year. And, you know, Nellie had a clear vision, you know, to keep the march going. And, you know, one thing that I've thought about, you know, since the decision came down, was that, you know, pro-lifers really owe a great deal of gratitude to, you know, people who came before us. That, you know, the 1970s, it was not easy to raise money to do pro-life work full-time. I mean, Nellie quit a good job as a government lawyer to devote herself to this cause. And keep in mind, the internet wasn't around in 1973. Direct mail was in its infancy. It was by no means clear how one goes about raising money to support oneself to do pro-life work, but she made that plunge. And you know, we thank them for efforts to this day. So again, I think the March is just a great, great event. It's one of the, I think, the happiest days of the year for me. I love seeing just the big crowds of people, the young people, the enthusiasm. It just really makes me very hopeful for the future.
Yeah, and it's what knit us together is kind of a fraternity, right? That where we just all kind of got to really know each other. If there's ever a movie made on the pro-life movement in 100 years, like Amazing Grace, there'll be a bar in that. There'll be a bar in the movie. What's the name of that bar? Tell everyone the name of the bar.
I think the bar in the movie, the Dubliner.
The Dubliner, right? It would have to be, so many scenes would be at this bar in Washington, D.C., Kitty Corner, and a little, oh, maybe a little more than Kitty Corner, but just a little bit down the road from Union Station. And it's a bar that if you walk into that bar, any day of the year, you're going to run into a friend if you're in the pro-life movement. Any day. Every time I go there, I run into friends. But if you go there on the day of the March for Life, any leader, all the leaders of the pro-life organizations, national, international, state, and local, they'll all be in there sharing a pint.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I joke that if you want to play pro-life celebrity bingo, go to the March like the night before the march. You know, that you'll see a lot of Catholic characters there enjoying some beers as fellowship. And it's just a great way to reconnect with, you know, friends from across the country and, you know, trade stories and catch up and kind of recharge our batteries for the next battles that we'll face that coming year.
So you gave us sort of this broad overview. We talked about the March for Life. Oh, we talked about the courts. Let's talk about politics. So, you know, the RNC for a long time didn't take our movement seriously, right? We were a very powerful special interest, but we didn't behave as a powerful special interest, and we were not treated with respect. When did that change, and how did that change?
It's really hard to kind of pinpoint an exact date, you know, but I just think that, you know, over time, you know, Republican Party just became a lot more pro-life. You know, I think eventually those Republicans that supported abortion either retired or lost primary challenges. And with a handful of exceptions, you know, if you want to be serious about doing business with the Republican Party, you have to be pro-life. You know, and I really think that it was probably, you know, around the time when, you know, George W. Bush was elected. I think kind of that's really, you know, when we started to really exert a lot more influence within the Republican Party. You know, we didn't have, you know, pro-abortion Republicans to block us or veto us or thwart us. And again, we didn't necessarily get everything we wanted, but we'll take some real steps forward. You know, issues like defunding Planned Parenthood, you know, finally really got on the table in ways they, you know, hadn't been discussed previously. I think that every successive Republican president has really made better and better judicial nominations. You know, I think the nominations of George W. Bush were better than the nominations of either his father or President Reagan. I think the Trump nominations are better than those of George W. Bush. So, you know, again, I think that we've just gained influence in the party. You know, they've been more receptive to things we've wanted.
You know, I worked for the RNC in 2004, and that was the first election cycle where the RNC developed a voter guide that had sanctity of life on the guide. And it only had five core issues. And I think that aggressive campaign led to Wisconsin becoming red, led to Scott Walker becoming governor. And so it had, I think that's where the RNC realized the utility and bowing, taking a knee to the pro-life movement. Don't know how sincere they were, but once they let us put the camel's nose in the tent, they woke up and we were, you know, the tent was ours.
Right. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, they just realized that in many parts of the country, it's just a winning issue. You know, that by and large, it's not an albatross. It's not something we have to hide behind. You know, we have to hide or be scared of, you know. Candidates running as pro-life in many parts of the country, you know, can win. And, you know, it's a good issue in a lot of swing states like Ohio and like Wisconsin. And, you know, these are states that sometimes vote Democrat, sometimes vote Republican, but they are states that are pro-life, that are organized, care a lot about the issue, and it can be beneficial to a candidate to run as a pro-life candidate in those states.
Okay, so with every perceived victory, there comes opportunities and there come threats. What would you say are the threats that we're facing in our campaign to protect the child in the womb?
I'd say there's a few threats we face. First is, I think, making sure that pro-life laws are enforced. You know, that there are some, you know, cities where local law enforcement may not enforce these laws or just may not prioritize enforcement. attorney general. Again, they may not force these laws the way they need to. So that's something we need to think about. Another kind of big issue we need to think about is chemical abortion. One thing we've noticed is that the percentage of all abortions, their chemical abortions, is going up. I think the most recent data from Guttmacher says as of 2020, 54% of all abortions are chemical abortions. And the reason why that's concerning is that, you know, we've passed protective laws in these states, but some groups will try to circumvent them by mailing these chemical abortion drugs to women in these states who want abortions. And, you know, that's awful. You know, I think there's legislation that we can pass to try to stop that. But it's also important to note that these chemical abortion drugs are, you know, fatal to unborn children, but also damaging to the health of women as well. I mean, we have studies showing that the complication rate from chemical abortions is 4 times the rate as the complication rate for a surgical abortion. And if women are taking these drugs without medical supervision, that poses some pretty serious health risks. If a woman has an ectopic pregnancy and she takes the chemical abortion pill, that can be fatal. If she's further along in gestation than she realizes, it's just a chemical abortion drug. That could have some.
But I think we should stop calling them chemical abortions and call it what they are. They're back alley abortions in a box.
Yep, that's a good way to put it.
They're back alley abortions in a box. And
you're right. We shouldn't sanitize it. I mean, that's exactly what's happening here.
And they're very especially dangerous to women. Supervised. You know, here's how it's going to unfold, I believe. I believe that, you know, we will have a human life amendment to the Constitution in the next 10 years. I do believe the battle around defining the abortion in a box, abortifacient abortions as abortion will be the challenge. People will want to believe it's contraceptives. But the reality is they're so devastating and deadly to women. In the end, I think that it will be through lawsuits and lawyers going after these pharmaceutical companies to defend women who have been wounded by these dangerous back alley abortions in a box, in a pill, chemical concoctions, and that will be what once and for all wipes away the abortion culture from the United States.
No, I think there's a good chance you're right. I mean, it's interesting that England for a while was letting women obtain these chemical abortion drugs, you know, through telehealth or through the mail, and they quit doing it. They weren't real vocal about it, but they realized that this was posing some pretty serious health risks, and there was an increase in hospital visits, you know, after these chemical abortion drugs were, you know, were administered. So again, this is obviously an issue that we need to be concerned about. Another thing that we need to be concerned about is that just a lot of blue states, they're really trying to make their abortion policy more permissive. That the past 5 years, we've seen both Illinois and Maine start funding elective abortions through their state Medicaid program. That means that women on Medicaid can tragically have their abortions be paid for with taxpayer dollars. It's not surprising in both states, you know, the most recent data shows that abortion numbers went up. It went up quite a lot. Massachusetts weakened their pro-life parental involvement law. And even if talks like in places like, you know, California, Governor Newsom, you know, wants to create a fund to help subsidize travel from other states who want to get abortions in California. So, you know, these are things we have to kind of push back against.
You know, it's really unbelievable to see what's happening. You know, I believe that with the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the red states are going to become younger, healthier, happier, wealthier, more vibrant, wonderful places to live. The blue states are going to become more violent. They're violent. They're going to become poorer, more totalitarian. And it's as if the blue states want to be the centers of vice in the republic, as if they're the bad neighborhood where people go to get their drugs and kill their babies. It's very weird.
Yeah, I think look where people are moving. I mean, you know, people tend to be moving, you know, away from blue states into red states. I mean, Texas has really seen its population grow dramatically. By and large, the economy is doing, you know, very well there. You know, they're a conservative state with, you know, solid conservative policies in place. And people are moving away from California for a variety of reasons. You know, that the economy, you know, hasn't always been good there. Housing prices are very, very high. You know, the business climate's not good. People want to start businesses. So, again, you're seeing people move away from places like California, but again, because of crime and other reasons, to places like Texas. And I think that trend will continue.
Okay, so we have the threat of or the challenge of making sure these laws are enforced. Do you see any other challenges where we could actually if we don't, if we're not on our game, we can, this could actually be a long-term setback?
Another big travel, you know, another big kind of challenge we face is women traveling out of state. You know, I mean, you know, essentially that, you know, it is possible for women to leave their own state and obtain an abortion in a state where the laws are more permissive. It's been frustrating to, like, my pro-life friends in Missouri, because right across the border is Illinois. And Illinois has, you know, much more permissive policies than Missouri does. You know, there are some groups working on this. You know, there's kind of questions, can we pass legislation that would make it, you know, difficult or impossible for a doctor to perform an abortion on an out-of-state woman? You know, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not going to speculate about that. But, again, these are things we have to think about in terms of law, but also just making sure we have good alternatives to abortion in all 50 states. But, you know, if we can really reach out to women and let them know there are resources available, we'll be less likely to cop across the border and get that abortion in a state where the law is more permissive.
Now, as a political scientist, if I missed anything, give us some, if you were traveling to Germany and they wanted to give a lecture on abortion in America over the past 50 years, what would be the three bullet points?
I'd say the three bullet points are, you know, number one, we kept the issue salient. You know, the March for Life, other things, you know, we made sure that this was an important issue. The fact that there were, you know, people to vote only on this issue, that meant a lot. The first thing is we kept the issue salient. Second thing, we got involved in politics and really invested heavily in the Republican Party to the point where if you're running as a Republican, you have to be pro-life to be taken seriously. You know, that Republicans were willing to do a lot more for us because of our investments. And third, you know, we just never gave up. You know, even when we lost elections, you know, even when, you know, the conventional wisdom amongst the media was that the pro-life position was hurtful, we just stayed with it. And we just fought this on as many grounds as we could. Politics was important. Laws are important. But we also, you know, help women in need through pregnancy help centers. We did educational efforts. We prayed. We sidewalk counseled. You know, we just fought this on as many grounds as we could. And again, we're enjoying a nice victory today because of that.
Yeah, you know, that's another example. I was a scout in the Army, and, you know, it's drilled in us that the importance of giving accurate information on what you see. It was MET-T. You had to give accurate information of what you see, and I think that was the acronym. And the left never really allowed itself to receive accurate information, did they? They hid the pregnancy center movement, which whenever people ask me, well, you'd have to agree the pro-life movement spends way too much money on politics and not enough on caring for women. I'd say, no, I think we don't spend enough money on politics because probably 90-plus percentage of our donations goes through local pregnancy centers to directly serve young women and their children. And the left, the mainstream media, they would call them fake clinics, which they were, of course, not. So they never addressed the reality that in every neighborhood in America, in every nook and cranny of our country, there were small communities of committed people serving a community.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they just sort of dismiss our efforts. I mean, they're very tough to deal with. They complain that pro-life people don't help women in need. And then we talk about pregnancy help centers. And, you know, they just dismiss our efforts. I mean, you know, here we are actually doing what they want us to do, help women through these pregnancy centers. And they call the names, dismiss them, roll their eyes. But it's important to note that,
firebomb them, threaten to kill the employees that work there.
Yeah, vandalize them. I mean, the Capitol Pregnancy Center in D.C., not far from the D.C. Planned Parenthood, yeah, they were vandalized. They had to actually pay extra money for security. But one thing that something pro-lifers have done well is in terms of increasing their numbers. I mean, there's about close to 3,000 now. Their numbers are increasing. You know, many state governments are actually willing to, you know, give them money or at least make them eligible for certain kinds of grants. So while they're increasing, you see abortion clinics closing. I think that's just a great sign of hope. If we have pregnancy centers opening up, helping women, building culture of life, and abortion clinics are destroying life or closing, those are two very, very good trends.
Now, I want to end with this. How did you respond? And we were together, actually. You and I were at a wake of a dear friend at the moment the opinion was leaked, and we had a great celebration. And then when the opinion came down, I would say I've been kind of shell-shocked, maybe numb. But there's been a range of people's responses to this. How did you respond?
Yeah, I was thrilled. You know, I was actually on my way to the court when I got the good news. And I did what most people did. I, went on to social media. I went on my Twitter account and announced the exciting victory and headed to the court to celebrate with my friends. And still, there's part of me that really can't believe it, you know, that we've been working so long and so hard for this. And I really enjoy, I used to be at University of Alabama. There's an abortion clinic there that I used to sidewalk counsel at. I enjoy going on their website and seeing they're not taking appointments anymore. That's a great victory for us.
The last abortion in Tennessee just happened. Unbelievable.
Yep, and I read the stories in the paper about clinics that actually, currently on Friday, just were turning people away. They're like, the Supreme Court, overturned Roe v. Wade, and our lawyers have said, don't do any more abortions, and they quit doing them for the day. So these things just give me a lot of gladness, and but also realizing that there are women in need that we have to take care of. We have to step up our efforts. So there's a lot of joy, a lot of strategic thinking too about what the next steps are, kind of both for pro-life activists here in D.C. and elsewhere. But it's been a busy week, but it's been a great week.
It has been a great week. Well, I look forward to seeing you soon. I don't know if this will be the last March for Life this coming January. Can't wait to be there. I had COVID during this past March for Life, I don't know if I missed the last March for Life. It's fine by me. That is a fair trade. There'll be still plenty of reasons to go to the Dubliner with my friends. We have a lot of work to do, and we're doubling down at Movie to Movement. We're preparing two documentaries, one on assisted suicide and euthanasia, a documentary, and we're going to be doing a narrative short film on the Ernest Hemingway story, Hills Like White Elephants. Very pro-life message embedded in that truth of that story, which is Ernest Hemingway's little confession on his responsibility for an abortion. But Dr. Michael New, having someone like you in our movement with skin in the game, you've had a lot to lose and sacrifice as a college professor. There is no more challenging place in America, maybe the world, than to be pro-life than an American university.
Well, I'm very blessed to be here at Catholic University. I have found a good institutional home where I have deans and colleagues who support my pro-life work. I think you just have to kind of do what you think is right. You can't let the world bully you around. You have to obviously be diplomatic with others and do your job well, but you can never hide or betray your core convictions. That's the advice I'd give to anybody.
Well, Dr. Michael New, thank you for giving us this broad overview of the pro-life movement. And if you ever have anything you want to inform us on with all of your research, ping me, and I'd love to have you back on the show.
Yes, sir. And if your listeners are interested in kind of what I do, I'm on Twitter. They can follow me at Michael_J_new. That's at Michael_J_new. They can also reach out to me on Facebook. And if they want to get involved with pro-life activism here in the D.C. area, I organize a sidewalk coffee outside the D.C. Planned Parenthood. They can reach out to me, and I'd be happy to work with them.
Yeah, you are a faithful presence in front of Planned Parenthood, which, when you're out in front of the abortion clinic in your community, you're ending abortion every day.
Yep, absolutely. I think there's a lot of great pro-life ministries, but in my opinion, there's no better way to build a culture of life than being a prayerful presence in front of an abortion facility.
All right. Dr. Michael New, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
God bless you. All right, guys, that was the great Dr. Michael New. Right there you have it. He just unfurled 50 years of the movement and hit some key points. And I'm going to need to have him back on and break down some of his research. As he said, we're going, as we go forward with thinking strategically, tactically, where do we go from here to really erect a culture of life? I'm going to land the plane. This episode is being brought to you by Epoch Times. Go to iReadEpoch.com, iReadEpoch.com. Use the code Jason Jones for your deep discount on your digital and print subscriptions. Being brought to you also by MyPillow. No better way to celebrate life than to kick the cancel culture in the face while resting your head on a soft pillow. Go to MyPillow.com. Use the code Jones when you click the radio listener square and get yourself a pillow, a victory pillow. Get yourself some slippers. Slip your feet in the slippers. Walk around the neighborhood smiling when you go to grab your Epoch Times newspaper. And of course, are you on the team, our team? And our team, this show is brought to you by our primary sponsor, the Vulnerable People Project. and we stand in solidarity with the vulnerable where there is a cost, where it's dangerous, and where very few people tend to go. That's, we stand with the vulnerable from the child in the womb to children in the most remote parts of Afghanistan, to orphans and shelters in Western Ukraine, to the Nuba Mountains of Sudan. When I founded the Vulnerable People Project as a program of our organization, HERO, I founded this organization because in college I was concerned about a lot of issues. And I realized that, I didn't call them woke yet, but the woke, they'll never stand with the vulnerable when there's a cost. And I want an organization that stands with those that no one else is willing to speak for because there is a social cost, a political cost, or at the least there is no reward. And this has been our most challenging year with the abandoning of our allies in Afghanistan, the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, and so we need all the help we can get. Go to thegreatcampaign.org. Give your very best one-time gift. Please, we have a lot of work to do this month, and we're overwhelmed, and become a monthly donor. When you become a monthly donor, that helps us budget so we know that what we can do. Right now, we have well going into our new medical center in a remote part of Afghanistan where only the men now by the Taliban were allowed to go to the hospital. So the women had no medical facility. There have been pregnant women who were dying and their children were dying. So we're building them a medical clinic with a fresh well. The well went in today. Pretty soon we're going to have video of this whole center being erected. We have schools for girls in Afghanistan. They're still operating. If you go to the Jason Jones Show YouTube channel, which I never promote, not a big YouTube fan, we got to move that somewhere else so we can actually do a video show. But you can see one of the girls' schools where we're providing security, security cameras and security guards for these girls. So there is a lot going on, not to mention we have thousands of SIVs, special immigrant visa applicants, that are qualified to be resettled in the United States because they're at risk. We're hiding them in safe houses and feeding them until we can get them successfully resettled. We need your help. That is thegreatcampaign.org. Until tomorrow, as we march along, 49 days of celebrating, thinking about, talking about the overturning of Roe v. Wade, we're going to continue with our 49 days in a row on the Jason Jones Show. Aloha.
This has been the Jason Jones Show, powered by Mudhouse Media.